I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Congress is holding hearings today. On the table, a move to raise the cap on BP's liability in the Gulf disaster from $75 million to $10 billion. Lawmakers are also looking to quadruple the tax on a barrel of oil from 8 cents to 32 cents to build up a cleanup fund. And President Obama will take questions about the disaster from reporters on Thursday. So what do people want the government to do? Glenn Thrush is senior White House writer for Politico. And Glenn, Coast Guard Commandant Thad Allen has made it clear the government is incapable of taking over the operation. But Billy Nungesser, the president of Plaquemines Parish in Louisiana, is telling you he wants President Obama to eliminate the middleman. What does he mean?
Well, Nungesser, when Obama was down there about 3.5 weeks ago, Nungesser pitched this plan to have these so-called jack-up boats monitor the oil flow and to put boom in based on what the local fishermen operating that boats would see. He had been turned down by officials in the Department of Interior. He brought his case to President Obama, toured the site with him for over an hour, and at the end of it, Obama said, "We're going to make this happen," and it happened. Since Obama has left, several other plans that Nungesser and other local officials have proposed haven't been received as well. And the big one that the locals are pitching, led by Bobby Jindal, the governor, is to put up this sand berm on the coast to block the oil from coming in. But the Army Corps of Engineers has been dragging its feet, saying that it'll take 6 to 9 months to do this, and they're not sure if it'll have a long-term negative effect on the environment down there. I think the problem is people want the government to do things. They want a sense that the situation is under control, and it's just not going to be under control until they stop the oil from flowing.
By the way, we mentioned yesterday there's a legitimate debate over using the sand for these sand berms because there's a shortage of sand because of storms pounding the area, so the concern is the oil would just go over the berms, and then you're also out of sand that you need for the shore. But at any rate, you had some thoughts on, you know, these calls from Republican Governor Jindal, Republican Parish President Nungesser.
Well, it's interesting. As you recall, Bobby Jindal was one of the governors who really was skeptical of the stimulus money when it was passed and really questioned this enormous government response to the financial crisis. And here you have the prospect of Jindal, a fellow who has become a bit of a hero on the right, calling for a much more interventionist federal response. You know, what do they say? There are no atheists in a foxhole. Apparently there are no pure capitalists during an environmental disaster. And that is very much different than the response of Haley Barbour, the governor of Mississippi, the former Republican National Committee chairman and lobbyist, who has dealt with much less oil. I don't think a drop has yet spilled up on the Mississippi coast. And he has essentially said that he supports the oil company and doesn't think that this should be used as a rationale for stopping offshore exploration.
But as you are writing, everybody becomes a socialist when the oil is lapping your shore.
Yeah, I think one's view of government changes with one's needs from government at any given moment.
Well, you know, we're talking about what people are telling you they want the president to do. You also spoke with General Russell Honoré, who helped oversee the government response to Hurricane Katrina. And he thinks the White House should declare a national disaster. What would that do, and why perhaps has the Obama administration not done that?
Well, they've done it in a limited sense. I think they've declared it a fisheries disaster, which would speed, I believe, $20 million or more in federal funding to deal with the fisheries disaster. But look, disaster declarations are essentially opening the door for federal funding. And the whole point here on the part of the Obama administration is not to open the floodgates for new federal money, but to force BP to write the first check wherever possible.
Yeah. Honoré is also wanting the administration to start collecting money from BP now. As we said, there are hearings today as to what the liability for BP might be. There's a move to raise the tax on barrels of oil to raise more money for a federal spill cleanup fund. But he says collect money now and set up a system now for assessing even daily fines against BP.
I think that's an idea that you're going to be hearing a lot more of, and I think at some point the administration is going to be clearly going to have to move in that direction.
That's Glenn Thrush, senior White House writer for Politico. Glenn, thank you so much.
Take care.
Let's turn to Facebook. They're facing a user revolt. Thousands of people are threatening to delete their Facebook profiles on Monday, May 31st, over privacy issues. That's prompted Facebook's founder, 26-year-old Mark Zuckerberg, to write an op-ed this week in the Washington Post, admitting that Facebook missed the mark when it introduced new privacy settings in December that made previously private information public. Today, Mark says he has new privacy settings that will be rolled out tomorrow. But Facebook could also be facing pressure from the government after the Electronic Privacy Information Center filed a complaint this month with the Federal Trade Commission. With Facebook approaching a half billion users, will all of these concerns have an impact on growth? Dan Fletcher wrote Time Magazine's cover story this week. He's also the magazine's social media producer. So, Dan, what do you make, first of all, of Mark Zuckerberg's comments this week?
Mark's recent statements here are indicative of Facebook's course throughout their history. I mean, they really push users to share more. They gauge the reaction. And then if the reaction is too strong or too hot, they pull back. So, you know, I don't think there's anything fundamentally different here for Facebook. Certainly, you know, I believe him when he said that they made a mistake. But that mistake isn't asking users to share more. That mistake is maybe asking them to share more right now.
Well, because down the road they feel that maybe they can go back and get them to share more. But just the statements of, we do not share your personal information with people or services you don't want. I mean, isn't the problem with that sentence that the privacy functions were so complex that you couldn't figure out how to do it?
That's part of the problem with Facebook, and it's been, again, a problem throughout their entire history, is that they just don't design privacy controls that are intuitive to use. It makes it very difficult, especially for users who are joining the site, which they are in great waves right now, to figure out exactly where their information's going. The settings may all be there, but to sort of tease out what happens when you adjust any single one of them is a very difficult thing.
Well, take us to this recent revolt. First of all, do you believe it? Do you think this is real, that people are going to delete their Facebook settings?
Some of them very well may. I think the large majority will not. I actually talked with Mark about this. And previously in their history, they had upwards of 10% of their user base revolt. That was in 2006 when they introduced the news feed, which is a real-time stream of your friends' updates. This latest outburst is nowhere near 10%. I mean, that would be on the orders of 50 million people complaining. This is a small, very vocal group of people who are upset, but probably won't make much of a difference in Facebook's bottom line.
And why are they upset? Just, take us through what happened in December.
So in December, Facebook did what they call a privacy revision. When you logged into the Facebook site, you were greeted with a dialogue that asked you to readjust your privacy settings. You had to do this before you used Facebook. Users had a couple different options. They could either accept Facebook's defaults, or they could delve into sort of this maze of settings and set them themselves. If you accepted Facebook's defaults, it ended up sharing a lot of your information, maybe even information that you didn't have shared before. And some of this stuff was pretty sensitive. Status updates, your profile picture, all of that became what Facebook dubs publicly available information.
And by the way, status updates?
A status update on Facebook's site is much like a tweet on Twitter or a text you send to a friend. It's an update of what you're doing. Or, you know, in a lot of cases, it can be sort of a complaint. There's a story every week about someone who gets fired for posting a Facebook status about why they hate their boss. So that becomes a very real problem when Facebook makes that information publicly available, because then you can search it and other people can find it, even if you don't think they can.
And prior to that, just your friends, people who were logged on as your friends on Facebook, could see it.
Right. So this change in December pushed a lot of that information. If you accepted Facebook's defaults, Facebook wants more of your information to be public. It wants to be able to do things with this data. And by making the defaults so open, they're sort of wagering that you're not going to take the time to figure it out, that you're just going to accept their defaults and move on and not really think about the implications.
And how hard was it if you wanted to change the defaults?
There's more than 50 different settings on the Facebook site, and you can very finely tune where each piece of information is being displayed. The problem comes when you have 50 different settings that a lot of people don't want to take the time to figure it out. So they don't, or they accept the defaults. So, you know, Facebook's argument is that they give you the tools to protect your privacy, and sort of the onus is on you to make sure you're doing it.
And by the way, you had to have a Facebook PR person, right, to help you change your privacy settings, and we assume you know a thing or two about doing this. And there's also websites, external websites, where you can check and see what's available about you?
Well, one of the most sort of troubling or tongue-in-cheek ones that launched this week is a site called Your Open Book. And what this site does is it lets you search everyone's publicly available status messages. So you can look for people who have used the phrase, I hate my boss, or I lost my virginity. And it's shocking how many people are posting this information in real time, and you can see their name and their picture. So, you know, if you're concerned that that information's out there, certainly you can do a test post and use one of the sites like this to search and see if you show up.
Well, so the point is, your information is potentially out there, but Mark Zuckerberg implies it's not. Here's what else he says in the Washington Post this week. We do not and will not give your information to anyone. We do not give advertisers access to your personal information. But then there's Facebook's new like button. Now, companies can put this button on their site, say it's Domino's Pizza, and if your friends click it, you may end up getting ads for Domino's Pizza on your Facebook page. Now, you call this peer pressure advertising, but it also sounds like it's someone sharing your information.
That statement's worded very carefully. Facebook, of course, is going to use all this information, including this like button that you mentioned there, on their site itself. Advertisers never really get to see you or your interests. They can only advertise to a pool of people. But you can make this pool very, very shallow. For example, you can just advertise to 23-year-olds who recently graduated from Harvard with an interest in pizza. That pool may only be a few hundred people strong, but advertisers can get access to it. So certainly on the advertising on Facebook's site, all this data they're collecting about you and that you're inputting from around the web is a very powerful tool for advertisers. For example, if you list swimming as an interest on your profile, it's very likely that you're going to get grouped into some advertiser's campaign targeting people who like swimming. And you're going to start seeing advertising for pools or maybe swimming lessons, lifeguarding classes on the side of your site. You know, and this is something that no one else on the web's really been able to gather at such a scale before. 500 million people each inputting their interest. There's a lot of data people can get at here, and Facebook's big bet is that advertisers are going to want access to this.
Well, because Facebook flashed more than 176 billion banner ads at users in the first 3 months of this year.
That's right. That's more than anyone else on the web.
Do those ads work?
I think the jury's still out on the sort of advertising Facebook's performing, certainly relative to other big online behemoths like Google. Facebook's advertising isn't as successful. A lot of these ads sort of fade into the background. I mean, this is nothing new. Google has the same sort of platform for this, where they're targeting people around a given search term or targeting you based on the text that's in your email. Facebook didn't pioneer this. They're just wagering that they can get more information at a better quality than anyone else.
Dan Fletcher, again, he wrote this week's Time Magazine cover story on Facebook. And as we said, people who don't like Facebook using their information to attract advertisers are going to leave the company on May 31st. Well, Dan says breaking up with Facebook is hard to do. That's next. Also later, speaking of your private information, when someone steals your medical insurance card, it can be worse than stealing your credit card, as we'll hear. But back with Dan Fletcher in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about Facebook and privacy. Dan Fletcher wrote Time Magazine's cover story about Facebook this week, and thousands of users are pledging to delete their Facebook profiles on Monday because they think Facebook has made too much of their public, their information public. But Dan, how hard will it be for these people to do that, to delete their profiles?
Facebook offers two distinct things you can do here. The first is deactivating your Facebook. And that's not all that difficult. If you deactivate your Facebook, it's basically like you go invisible. All your photos, all your status updates, everything about you goes behind the wall, but it still exists. Facebook still has it, and it's very easy, and they make it very easy for you to sort of regret leaving Facebook and to come back. Deleting your Facebook is a little more of a process. You actually have to send a message to Facebook support, and sometimes it takes up to 14 days for your information to be purged from the system. So to leave permanently is a little more difficult.
It's like leaving a cult.
That's right. And if you do it, if you attempt to deactivate, they actually show you pictures of your friends with a little message that these people will miss you if you leave. You know, don't go.
Hey, but the stuff that's on Facebook, if you want to leave, is it yours? Do you get to take it?
If you want to leave completely, if you want to delete yourself from the system, they have to purge your information. So you certainly do have control in that respect. But they don't offer, and they've had criticism for this, they don't make it very easy for you to transfer all your photos and all your information to another social network, which is part of why it's very difficult for any competitor of Facebook to pop up.
And it's working. I mean, just give us a little bit of context here. How hooked are we on Facebook?
We're tremendously hooked. The statistic we sort of lead the piece off with is that probably by the end of June, Facebook will have more than 500 million active users. And those are active users. Those are people who have logged in the last 30 days. So the total number of accounts is even higher than that.
Nearly a billion unique images a week. This might be the largest photo collection in the world.
We think it is. And, you know, these aren't just, you know, snapshots. These are photos of friends. These are people's first steps, things with a very tangible emotional connection to them.
Well, and talk about some of the other ways that parties were able to either piggyback on Facebook or take advantage of Facebook.
So one of the things Facebook's drawn the most flack for is this instant personalization program. And it's a very limited program. They launched it with three sites, which are Yelp, Pandora, and Docs.com, which is a Microsoft site. And what this does is it lets these sites sort of tap into your Facebook profile and pull all your data, all your interests, all your friends, all your sort of attributes into the site. So if I log into Pandora, which is a streaming music service using my profile, that site's already pre-populated with my favorite bands. It knows what music I like before I set foot on the site for the first time. I mean, for a user, and this is what Facebook's argument is, this is a tremendously awesome thing. But this was something that Facebook automatically opted all its users into, and it brought up a lot of concerns, particularly since it wasn't always very clear what data these sites could actually access.
Well, and some people would say, how good is it for the user if you never get to think outside of what a computer is telling you is your area of interest?
That's right. I mean, it kind of removes the serendipity from things. These sites know you. There's no chance to discover new things on your own.
And that they know you. I mean, that's where I guess I'm getting hung up. Facebook is saying they're not sharing my information. Well, maybe they're not sharing it with a human, but they're sharing it with another computer site that knows how to aggregate information about me.
Well, this would be one of the occasions where Facebook is sharing your information. They're not sharing it for advertising. They're sharing it to let these sites offer a very custom, very familiar experience to you without you having to do anything. So they absolutely are sharing their information, and that's what made people really uneasy, is that they never sort of authorized this, and they may not trust these sites. But Facebook's argument is that they have really tight contracts to control these sorts of things, and you know, it's almost as if Facebook built these applications themselves.
Can you unenroll in instant personalization?
You absolutely can. You can either unenroll by going to the sites themselves and saying, no thanks, I don't want to do this. Or there is a setting in Facebook's privacy options where you can opt out of instant personalization.
So Dan Fletcher, where do you think this is all going? I mean, look even just into the near future. What do you see happening with Facebook?
I think it's going to be very, very difficult to stop. Once a site accumulates 500 million people, and once it gets as much information as we've put in, it's very difficult to leave. And, you know, I think the sort of initiatives they're doing right now are going to be tremendously successful. They make it very easy now for you to input your interests from anywhere you go on the web, not just on Facebook.com. And there's a big incentive for websites to sort of tie this information in, too, because they want to get access to your Facebook friends. They want to get access to traffic from Facebook. So they've positioned themselves very, very intelligently. And, you know, I think absent some sort of government intervention, some sort of action by the FTC that says, no, you can't use data in this way, we're going to see it continue to grow and continue to be more of a presence across the web.
Dan Fletcher, just one last thing. You've gone deep into this. You're a Facebook user. You sign off after raising big philosophical questions by saying, well, time to go see if my ex-girlfriend has added new photos. That's funny, but also chilling. So what advice would you give, particularly parents with young people on Facebook? They have allowed 13-year-olds on.
Well, first of all, I'm going to save my reputation here. I cleared that line with the ex-girlfriend. She got a kick out of it. Yeah. So I'm not quite as creepy as it might make me seem. But, you know, it does raise a very, very interesting question, which is, you know, sort of these connections you make on Facebook are persistent. People you don't even know have access to a lot of intimate data about you. People you might not want having that data can sort of access it and get a lot of ideas about who you are and what you're doing on the Facebook site. And again, you know, as much control as Facebook builds in, and even if they make it easier with a new set of changes, the onus is always on you as the user, and in, you know, the case of 13-year-olds, their parents, to really think about the types of information you're putting out there and the types of people you're connecting with on the site.
Dan Fletcher, a reporter, social media producer for Time Magazine. His cover story on Facebook privacy is at our website, hereandnow.org. Dan, thanks so much.
It was a pleasure.
Did you know it cost almost 2 cents to make one penny and 9 cents to make a nickel? President Obama wants to lower those costs by changing the composition of some coins. And the Treasury Department agrees that making coins from more cost-effective materials could save more than $100 million a year. But what will that mean to, oh, say, people who run laundromats? Rod Gillis is with the American Numismatic Association. He goes to schools and teaches kids about currency and the history of coins. So, Rod, first tell us, what are pennies and nickels made from now?
Currently, our cents are made primarily out of zinc with a slight washing of copper, copper being sort of expensive now. With nickels, they're made of nickel and copper with a small portion of manganese. I'm not exactly aware of what the administration has in store for a change, but I would imagine that it would involve something with the use of aluminum.
Well, so we had steel pennies in 1943 because of copper shortages during World War II. Ronald Reagan changed pennies to add the zinc that you spoke of.
Correct.
But who's resisting the change now?
Well, the problem is that the coins, they'll need to be the same in diameter and they'll need to be the same weight. If not, it'll throw any sort of vending machines or parking meters off.
Well, that's why, for instance, the Coin Laundry Association told the Wall Street Journal they want to make sure there aren't unintended consequences, so suddenly you have to spend tons of money to remake machines. That's why when Richard Nixon tried to change the penny in the 70s, machine vendors objected then. So what do you think is going to happen with this plan by the Obama administration and the Treasury Department?
My sense is that our country as a whole is so very opposed to change in our money. If you look at the history of our coinage, it's been very stable for very many years. And so if you were to have a coin that is made out of aluminum, just the feel of it in your hands is entirely different. And there's just a feeling of a cheapness to it that I think the people who, you know, use money in our economy would be very much against.
But, you know, on the other hand, we all got over that big pink five or $5 bills. And, you know, Rod Gillis, that reminds me, while we have you, here you are, a numismatist. So a couple other questions about currency. First of all, you say that if you have a torn or damaged bill, it counts, but only if you have what? How much do you have to have of, let's say, a torn dollar bill?
Technically, you need to have 51%.
Ah.
Because if it was 50% exactly, then you could cut bills in half and double your money.
Ah, there you go. And you also tell us you've been getting a lot of calls from people who want to invest in coins, so much so that you've actually heard from people withdrawing all their money from retirement accounts to invest in coins?
We do get people all the time call, and they're very concerned with the economy as it is now. They're concerned that the dollar as we know it will become worthless, and so they're investing in precious metals. And I've had people call me and say, you know, I've just withdrawn all my money, I'm ready to turn it over, and I want you to tell me what coin I should buy that will appreciate in value. And I just can't do that for a whole host of reasons.
Well, and what you do tell them is call a financial advisor and maybe you should put all your money back. Because the other thing that people say about you is you're called the dream crusher. Because how many people have called you and say, I've got the coin that is worth so much money?
Yeah, that happens, unfortunately, all the time. And in most instances, when they call, they have a coin that is odd to them, and so they equate that with value. The other thing is that people equate a coin that is old must be valuable. And that's really not the truth. An example of that would be that there are ancient Roman coins that you can purchase for $5 or $6 a piece.
Well, what is it that makes a coin valuable?
Number one is the actual mintage number. How many of a particular coin was made? So we, for example, have a 1913 Liberty nickel where 5 were made. That's a very valuable coin.
Do we know where they are? Should we run?
Well, actually, 2 of them are here at our museum.
Ah, so that leaves
so
3.
So 2 of the 5, yes. The second variable is the condition of the coin. Naturally, a coin that is in higher condition has more value to it. And the third variable is really the demand for a coin. For some reason, a coin may be seen as especially beautiful, or it's significant for the year that it was made, and therefore their value goes up. So those are the three things. Age really has very little to do with the value of a coin.
Rod Gillis from the American Numismatic Association, ahead of plans to change the makeup of the penny and the nickel to make them more cost-effective. Rod, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And we'll be back in about 30 seconds here and now.
The average cost incurred when someone's identity is stolen is about $4,800, and that's pretty bad. But the average cost of medical identity theft is more than double that, a little more than $12,000. Not only is health identity theft more costly, but it costs more to resolve cases, about $2,200 on average of out-of-pocket costs to consumers. So what is medical identity fraud? Well, Margaret Collins is a Bloomberg Businessweek columnist. Margaret, start there. How does this type of fraud work?
Well, medical identity theft tends to take two main forms. In one case, criminals will steal your personal information and use it to obtain medical goods and services, like drugs or surgeries, under your name. And in the other case, they use your information to bill for procedures that are never done.
Well, so what might some of the surgeries and procedures be?
So, for example, I talked to a woman in California who was billed $12,000 for a liposuction she never had or never requested.
So how does she know about this? Is she just gets it on her healthcare credit card?
Exactly. So oftentimes medical identity theft cases take a while to be uncovered because people don't oftentimes check their insurance claim forms or charges that may appear on their medical information documents. But this woman was looking through her healthcare credit card bills in November of last year and realized that there was a charge, $12,000 charge, called the healthcare clinic that was listed for the charge and realized that someone else had billed it in her name.
In fact, you talked to someone else who didn't find an unpaid medical bill until he went to buy a new home and his credit report was reviewed. What did he find?
Right, exactly. He found charges that included thousands of dollars for emergency medical treatments at several different emergency rooms and even a life flight helicopter, which cost, I think it was about $19,000 on his bill. And because the criminal had most likely changed the address on his bills, he never received them until he went to buy a home and his credit report showed up with a lot of these unpaid medical bills.
Oh my goodness. So it sounds as if two things can happen. First of all, somebody can get a hold of your card and just book an appointment to get liposuction and go in, and come to think of it, all someone asks for is your card once you go in. They don't ask for any other identity.
Right. So oftentimes people don't ask for additional information when you go in for a procedure, such as proving that you're the person that matches the address and name on healthcare information or your insurance card. So hospitals like the Mayo Clinic are actually starting now to institute in their systems asking patients if they would agree to having their photo on their file in the computer so that they can match the face with the person who's requesting the treatment.
How else might someone steal your medical identity if not with your card?
They could do it by stealing your information in terms of downloading files on a computer if medical professionals have access to the data inside a hospital. There are cases where people have downloaded thousands and thousands of files and taken people's social security number, healthcare information number, name, address, and then use that information to bill for phony treatments that never happened or to actually bill for procedures and by impersonating the person and getting it done in their name.
You speak to an identity protection service that says that health care and your health care information is becoming the new credit card. In other words, instead of stealing your credit card, they're stealing your health care, and it's the same effect. They're getting, you know, running up all these costs. And I'm imagining, too, sometimes when the hospital submits to the insurance company, these surgeries and other events might get paid for, but most of the time they're not. So, for instance, that woman with the liposuction charge, did she have to pay for that?
She did not, actually. She went to the clinic and worked with the clinic to actually catch the woman who ultimately was arrested when she went for an appointment.
But in other cases, not that that's easy, but in other cases, it's not that easy. And we understand the victim has to pay a lot of money out of pocket to get their credit cleared.
Correct. It can take a while to resolve it. And also, it can sometimes I talk to, identity experts who said when it comes to medical identity theft, it can be a life or death situation because oftentimes your medical record will be altered to reflect diseases or treatments you never had, which can be life threatening for you if you, walk into the doctor's office and they think you had a treatment that you didn't have. So in that case, it can be quite dangerous for the person who is a victim.
And some would think that digitizing medical records, which is something the Obama administration wants to do, they say it will cut costs, that it might help, but you say it might not. Why?
Well, identity experts that I talked to said once you put medical records online, it makes it easier for criminals to access them, by thousands at the time. So instead of taking one paper file or file folder that may be on a doctor's office desk, you might have access to thousands of files, be able to download them on a thumb drive, and then walk out. So they say the crime can scale upwards quickly.
Well, some of these sound pretty extreme. The fellow who found out that he had unpaid medical bills on his credit report when he went to buy a home found that there were more than $100,000 in these unpaid bills. But are we sensationalizing this? I mean, how much does this happen? How many cases are there?
Well, a report by Javelin Strategy and Research, which is a research market research firm based in California, said the number of cases doubled between 2008 and 2009. And identity experts would say it's growing in large part, because of more and more information being accessible online.
Well, you're right. There might be fewer cases than identity theft. There's something like 275,000 cases of medical identity theft a year, but they're six times more costly.
Right, because it often takes a lot longer for the victim to resolve it. One, because it tends to go undetected for longer, and also it takes a while longer in a lot of cases to resolve your file. So tips that consumers might want to be aware of is you may want to request a copy of your insurance claim file once a year just to see if there's anything on there that doesn't look right. And then also you may want to ask for a copy of your medical records after you go for an appointment. Again, just to stay on top of your file and have a copy of it so that you have a record if something does pop up later, you can show it to police or the Federal Trade Commission in order to have it resolved more quickly.
And Margaret, this is identity theft, medical identity theft.
Correct.
But is there also, seeing that it can be done, are there also people who actually may sell or give away their medical insurance cards to uninsured friends?
Yes, there are certainly people out there who need health insurance and don't have it. And as we have heard certainly over the past year, how expensive health care has gotten, there are people who sell the information to people who are in need because they don't have insurance. And it's a lucrative market for that as well.
That's Margaret Collins, staff writer with Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. Margaret, thanks so much.
Thank you.
In his new book, David Lipsky writes, "Suicide is such a powerful ending, it reaches back and scrambles the beginning." The suicide he's talking about is that of David Foster Wallace, the best-selling author of the massive novel Infinite Jest and other works of fiction and nonfiction. David Foster Wallace hanged himself in 2008, even after working closely with his parents and sister and friends like author Jonathan Franzen to try to find the right medication for his depression. Well, David Lipsky decided to go back and unscramble some of David Foster Wallace's beginnings before that terrible end by going back to tapes he'd made of the time they spent together in 1996. Now, at that time, David Foster Wallace was arguably the most popular writer on the planet. Rolling Stone magazine sent David Lipsky to Bloomington, Illinois to profile him. The result was never published until now. Transcripts of those tapes are in the new book, Although, Of Course, You End Up Becoming Yourself, A Road Trip with David Foster Wallace. And author David Lipsky joins us from NPR New York to talk more about it. David, welcome.
Thanks, Robin. It's great to be here.
Ian, put this in context. 1996, David Foster Wallace, sort of a rock star. You write, he earthquaked New York with articles like his cruise ship piece, an essay in Harper's. Just why? How did people react to that piece?
I think they reacted the way people reacted in the 50s when they first read Salinger. It was kind of when you opened up a magazine to read one of his essays, instead of finding words, it was like finding a kind of mirror. I remember that at the time that Infinite Jest came out, I was at a party, and a woman sat down next to me and looked at all the aspiring and successful writers in the room and said, every relationship in this room is being ruined by David Foster Wallace. Because when he's in the paper, the women are like, ah, David Foster Wallace is so cute. And the guys are like, I want to be David Foster Wallace. So it was just this incredible joy about a new writer. And then this, here's this guy who's done what everyone wanted to do.
And what is that? Can you try to put your finger on it? You know, the cruise ship piece, people faxing it to each other, reading it out loud over the phone. It told of, you know, it's simple concept. He's taking a trip on a luxury cruise. What was it about his writing?
What David talks about in his work is that writing is the thing that allows us to not feel lonely. He's able to kind of capture your brain voice. Do you know the way your brain, you'll be thinking about what you're seeing, you'll be thinking about a movie line you liked, you'll be thinking about something you want to say to somebody else, and there are all those thoughts going at once. When he writes, he gets all that out in a very clean, very clear, very funny way, and suddenly you know what the sound of your own brain is, and that's a thrilling thing. There's no other writing like it.
For instance, he'd make an observation about the way people smile at you when they don't really mean it, and 3 pages later, he'd gone through 10 footnotes about, you know, phony smiles, and then, but you really want the smile. Why aren't they smiling at me? And it just...
Yeah, and then he ends with, what a damn mess.
All right. Infinite Jest. You want to try? You take a shot at what this huge book was about?
Sure. Infinite Jest is about everything, but it really is about how the world feels now. I mean, there are great stories about people in 12-step programs and people at a tennis academy. But the real thing it's about and why it was thrilling is it's about how it feels to live at a time when you're transacting a huge amount of your life through electronic data, when you're transacting a great deal of your connections with other people through electronic screens. It's about what it feels like to be alive now.
Yeah.
Again, there's no other book like it.
And here you are. Rolling Stone assigns you to do a profile on him. You spend 4 or 5 days with him. This was at the end of his book tour for Infinite Jest. You play chess. You get iced in at an airport. You sleep in his spare room. What did he say to you? His spare blanket is your spare blanket. You watch him with his dogs that he loves. You eat with him at Denny's and McDonald's. You record all this. So when you go back to listen to it, and you also wrote a profile in Rolling Stone in 2008, who did you hear? Who'd you find?
His writing is as funny and charming as alive as any writing I've ever read. In person, he was like that, too. He was just completely shockingly awake. Like, when we checked into the hotel in Minneapolis, the woman at the desk said to me, you know, and your room has two twins. And David said, yes, Anita and Consuela. We walked into a Denny's, and I was surprised there was a smoking section. And David said, yes, there's even a chain-smoking section at Denny's. I remember we were at Mall of America, and we were looking around. It was he was a really funny person to be at Mall of America with, because he was looking at the store names. And he looked across, and there was a restaurant called Hulk Hogan's Pasta Mania. And he said, when I think pasta, I think Hulk Hogan. I'm sorry, I blew the line.
No, that's great. Was that the line?
Okay.
I mean,
yeah, that's the line. Just a brilliant, brilliant mind, incredibly fast, and incredibly funny and cheerful. Just because if you can take in all that information, somehow it's going to make you cheerful, I think, too. And that is what I want to capture in the book.
But there's also a whole stretch. You're both exhausted from the tour, and he just seems to spill his guts. He tells you about how when an earlier book that he'd written, I think it was his second, when it tanked, he became suicidal. How, you know, he talked about when he was at Harvard and went into McLean's psychiatric hospital. In essence, what we're hearing there is, you know, Infinite Jest might not have been written. As sad as the real ending is, it was almost sadder.
To me, the amazing thing about him going into McLean in 1989 is that within a year or two of that, he has himself stable. He begins working on the novel in 1992, and he's done by 95. And to me, part of what's really very inspiring about having gotten to live this time with him again is remembering just what an amazing feat that is to bring off, to have thought, you know, he said at the time after he had gone into McLean that he thought his life was over, he thought he was done. And then 6 years later to write what is the best novel by anyone of his generation. It's just an amazing thing. It shows just how strong he was, too.
In looking back and listening back, you know, in these beginnings of a story, did you see the end? Is there a point where you said, oh, I wish I'd done this or done that? Or no, because, you know, he's so open about his depression. It's not as if this was a secret.
David had kept secret that he was on antidepressants, which came out after his death. Towards the end of his life, David tried to switch medications at the advice of some of his doctors, and it was a bad drug reaction that really led to his suicide. It wasn't the pressure of being a writer, and it wasn't the pressure of his senses that drove him to take his own life. It was, in many ways, very clearly just a medical reaction. If you had asked me in August of 2008 who the most healthy American writer is, I would have said, without hesitation, David Foster Wallace.
In fact, we have a passage from your conversations. Remember, this is a 14-year-old cassette tape. It's towards the end of the time you spent together, these several days. Let's listen.
If you can think of times in your life that you've treated people with extraordinary decency and love and pure, uninterested concern just because they were valuable as human beings, the ability to do that with ourselves, to treat ourselves the way we would treat a really good, precious friend, or a tiny child of ours that we absolutely love more than life itself. And I think it's probably possible to achieve that. I think part of the job we're here for is to learn how to do it.
David, what do you take from that?
That's the voice of somebody who was extremely intelligent and extremely warm, trying to decide, trying to pick a way to live. I mean, it really brings me back to being there in his little house in Bloomington. But it's also part of what makes him so special as a writer, is that not only is he seeing life clearly, he kind of gives readers, he gives me as a reader, a sense of ways I might try to live too.
Hmm. Well, David Lipsky, before we let you go, just tell us something else that David Foster Wallace told you about writing.
I mean, he had a really clear idea of what writing was supposed to be. He said that he liked writing that worked on your nerve endings, and he said that with real writing, there was a kind of stomach magic. He said that, that goddamn, it's so much fun to read, I'd rather read right now than eat.
Yeah.
He was talking, it was very funny, he saw kind of what makes some people uncomfortable now about things like Facebook or about Twitter or about IMing and texting each other. He said that technology would get better and better at doing what it does, which is leaving us alone in front of screens, and that we were going to have to invent some machinery inside our guts to help us deal with that. I think of that every day because I haven't, and most people I know haven't quite done that gut-building machinery. You know, we haven't done that gut-building work yet.
David Lipsky, his book is Although, of Course, You End Up Becoming Yourself, A Road Trip with David Foster Wallace. David, thanks so much for speaking to us about it.
Robin, it was great to be on. Thanks for having me.